Today is Wednesday, June 28th. We're going to wrap up muscle information and start nervous system information today. All right, so on the top of page 83, we're going to talk about excitation-contraction coupling. And it's actually a two-part process to make sure that muscles know to contract. So we're going to start with the process of excitation first. And this involves a stimulus that comes from a nerve cell. You're actually looking at an up-close view of a neuromuscular junction. That is the relationship between an axon terminal of a motor neuron and one single skeletal muscle. So it's a real close relationship. We know that the nerve and the muscle don't actually touch. What's the name of the space between the two cells?
Synapse.
Good. Or synaptic cleft. Good. So since we can't actually tap the muscle and say, hey, I've got a message for you, we communicate using a chemical called a neurotransmitter. What specific neurotransmitter are we going to use?
Acetylcholine.
Good. So let's say that you've decided to pick up a pencil and write. When your brain tells your arm that you're going to write, the nerve impulse travels down your spinal cord and out a spinal nerve that innervates the biceps brachii muscle. So we're looking at a nerve impulse traveling down the length of this axon terminal. The nerve impulse is going to cause the opening of a certain type of channel. What type of channel is going to let calcium come in? Protein channel. Good. So these protein channels open up, calcium rushes into that axon terminal, and that allows for these vesicles that look like little blisters here to pop and release their neurotransmitter simply by exocytosis. So here they come, they're exiting by exocytosis. And inside the synaptic cleft there, we see those acetylcholine molecules. Okay, so when acetylcholine is present in your synaptic cleft, it then migrates across into that neighboring sarcolemma, and it binds to a specific type of sodium channel. There's a little receptor sitting there for that acetylcholine to bind. What happens to your sodium channel when acetylcholine does bind?
It opens
up. Good. What happens now to the inside of your muscle cell when we open sodium channels? That's it. Gets excited. Good. And what comes rushing into your muscle cell?
Sodium.
Good. So the excitement of having all this sodium rush in causes a change in the charge in there. So we've got now a real positive charge from all these sodium ions sitting inside your muscle cell. So that accomplishes our first process known as excitation. Now, we don't necessarily want to leave acetylcholine bound to those receptor sites. If you leave acetylcholine sitting bound, what happens to your sodium channels?
They stay open.
Good. And what happens to your muscle cell?
Continues
to contract, right. So how do you recycle and get rid of that acetylcholine? Good. ACHE is, yeah, that's it, acetylcholinesterase. And what job does it perform?
Breaks down
acetylcholine, allows it to be reuptaken to that axon terminal, and very importantly, it does what to those sodium channels?
Closes
them, right? It's like taking the key out of the lock, the door shuts, and that's it. No more excitation at that point. Okay, so that's excitation. What I'd like to do now is move you into contraction. And during contraction, we've got all this sodium inside the cell, and the excitement actually travels down one of these T-tubules. So thinking back to our discussion on Monday, a T-tubule is a deep portion of the plasma membrane, or sarcolemma, and it travels near one of those sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, and that should flip us over to page probably 84 and 85, getting into that contraction information. So what does all this excitement tell your SR to release?
Calcium,
good. When the calcium is released, that calcium comes over to one of these thin filaments, and it binds a specific portion known as?
Troponin.
Good. So when calcium binds troponin, there's a rope-like molecule known as?
Troponin.
Good. And that moves out of the way. When you reveal the binding sites now on the actin filaments, the myosin heads take advantage. They reach up and form
Cross bridges,
good. So the cross bridge is not necessarily going to move the muscle. What has to happen to the head to make the muscle slide? Pivot, power stroke. Good. So just making a cross bridge is not enough. Got to pivot and do a power stroke, and that makes your thin filament slide. So we have to do this again and again to make the muscle shorten. What powers the release of the myosin head?
ATP.
ATP, good. That lets the head release, repeat, and as long as your actin filament's binding sites are revealed, then we can continue to perform power strokes. So when you're done with the muscle contraction, let's put everything back to rest. So what is going to be removed from your troponin complex?
Calcium,
good. Where do you store calcium?
In the
SR. Once you take the calcium away, what happens to your tropomyosin rope?
It covers
back up, right. And now that you have binding sites covered, can you make cross bridges?
No.
Muscles relax, good. So the muscle lengthens, it slides back out to its normal position. You're done with muscle contraction at that point. Okay, so that is contraction. That's the second half of the process. What I'd like to do is walk you back through the videos that we watched in here on Monday, and I've got a second video that I'd like to show you as well. So I think the more we talk through it, the more we'll be comfortable with this. This is a storytelling process, so if you can go home and tell the story, then you know you've got this process down pat. Okay. Before we get into the process of telling the story one more time, are there any questions or anything that I can clarify for you?
Tensile wheels, can you?
Sure. That yellow piece sticking into the muscle cell, it's just a piece of the plasma membrane, and it's kind of like it injects a nerve impulse deep into the SR, so that way we have all these injection sites along the length of the muscle, and all of them get the nerve impulse instantly, yeah, so they all contract together as a unit. Okay, how about other questions? Anything I can clarify for you? Okay. Whoops, didn't mean to put it down. Let's see. Okay, so this has sound. I'm just going to leave the sound off and walk you through it. This is the excitation movie. They're showing us the nerve impulse traveling down a motor neuron to a skeletal muscle. And the piece they're showing us here is actually called a motor end plate. That's this little area where all those axon terminals are sitting. And so those axon terminals are going to release a neurotransmitter. We know that neurotransmitter is called what?
Acetylcholine.
Good. Let me pause here for just a moment so we can take a look. What you're looking at is an axon terminal coming down here in yellow. Down below, you're looking at the sarcolemma of the muscle cell. And they've made it really small, but right here, kind of in a purple color, those are the sodium channels. And, of course, they're closed right now because we have no what?
No excitement.
No excitement, right. What does it take to open those channels?
Acetylcholine,
yeah. And over here, you've actually got a T-tubule running in right there, another T-tubule running down there, and in dark blue down here, that is the SR. And what does it store?
Calcium.
So, in fact, when the nerve impulse comes, it's going to zap deep into that SR and says, hey, SR, release your calcium. And it's like an instant release of that calcium into the sarcoplasm. Okay, so they're going to show us now the nerve impulse traveling down the length of that axon terminal. There it comes. And as we zoom in, you're going to find that there are calcium channels that are now open thanks to that action potential. And when we let calcium come into the axon terminal, what does that allow us to do next?
Release synaptic vesicles.
Good. Release those vesicles. There they are. And what do they contain? choline, good. So those acetylcholine molecules now travel out into your synaptic cleft. They are heading for those sodium channels, which are shown here as green. I think they look like lettuce leaves. And there they go. They bind to receptors on those sodium channels. And in response, those sodium channels will open up. Good. What should travel into your muscle cell through one of those sodium channels?
Sodium.
It's like the old joke, who's buried in Grant's tomb, right? Who comes in through sodium channels? Sodium. Okay, and there comes the sodium rushing into the interior of your muscle cell. This excitement is going to change the environment in here to a very positively charged environment. This is the best part of this animation because they're going to zoom back. There's the SR down here in dark blue. And then right here, you're going to watch the action potential. That's the excitement of sodium that rushes down into those T-tubules. And the next step, of course, is calcium being released from that SR. So now that we're done with the muscle contraction and the excitement portion, we're going to put away that acetylcholine using an enzyme called?
ACHE.
Good. Acetylcholinesterase, ACHE. I think it looks like Pac-Man. Here it comes. And its job is to recycle and break down acetylcholine into acetic acid and choline, let it get reuptaken to that axon terminal, and then we're ready for the next time that we need it. So by getting rid of that acetylcholine, what happens to your sodium channels?
They close.
They close. What happens to the excitement in your muscle cell?
It stops.
It stops, yeah. And of course, you're done with the process when the excitation is over. Let's now flip over to the cross-bridge cycle. So we know that muscles do not push, their only job is to pull, and they do that by shortening. And the shortening process is involving the sliding of filaments past one another. So we looked at this one on Monday. This red portion here is actually showing us the sarcomere. We notice that it shortens when the muscle contracts. What are the two types of filaments that we can see in this picture?
Actin and myosin.
Actin and myosin, good. Which ones are anchored to Z-lines?
Actin
or thin, good. And in this picture, the actin or thin filaments are what color?
Yellow.
Yellow, good. In between those thin filaments, we have a much thicker filament made up of the protein called?
Myosin,
good. Which one of our filaments contains little projections known as heads?
Myosin,
good. And we're talking about those thin filaments. Thin filaments not only have actin, but we have two other proteins known as?
Tropomyosin and troponin complex.
Good. Tropomyosin and the troponin complex, good. So what we've got right now is called a sarcomere. That is the distance between one Z-line. Good, good. And right now, can you tell me if this muscle is relaxed or contracted?
Relaxed.
How do you know?
You see the H-zone?
H-zone, good. Right through the middle there. There are no what filaments in the H-zone?
Thin.
No thin, good. And you can also see what else?
I-band.
Yeah, I-band is visible. The I-band should contain no
myosin
or thick filaments, right. So right now we're looking at a relaxed muscle, one that is lengthened. So if your arms hang down by your side, this would be biceps brachii at the relaxed state. Okay, so upon contraction, what happens to your H zone?
Disappears.
Good. And your I band?
Disappears.
Good. All right, so let's pause again. We've got our thick filament, myosin heads. And then in yellow, we have our thin filament. The yellow specifically is what protein?
Actin.
Good. The green rope is?
Tropomyosin.
Good. And the complex right there?
Troponin.
Good. What type of ion binds troponin?
Calcium.
Good. And when calcium binds troponin, what happens to the whole actin filament? Binding sites. Good. Those active binding sites are going to be revealed. Okay, so that's in fact what we're going to watch There comes calcium. There is that rope of tropomyosin. It moves. We have the binding sites revealed, and that head, of course, forms a cross bridge. Good. So the head forming a cross bridge occurs anytime those binding sites are revealed. They showed you a power stroke, and now they're going to let the head release using ATP, because this is like the repeat cycle. We bind, we pivot, we release, we do it again. Okay, so we'll let this thing start off with step one. We know we're ready for muscle contraction in this picture because you see what? Good. Binding sites are there on the actin filaments. You're right. They're ready for the myosin head to bind. When the myosin head binds to those actin binding sites, we call it a
cross bridge,
right? So it's a binding of that head to that actin filament. That alone is not enough to make a muscle shorten. You have to have this next step called a power stroke. So what should happen to the myosin head?
Pivots.
Pulls, yeah, that's it. So, of course, we can't pull very far just with one head pivoting, so we repeat this over and over. Every time you release the head, you use what molecule?
ATP.
Good. I promise you it's not this slow in real life. In real life, this process is extremely fast. That the phosphate comes off, it is attaching to that myosin head, and then the ADP is what's left as a lower power form. Yeah. And eventually we'll put the two back together and make ATP. Yeah. So the whole goal here is to make those heads power stroke, pivot, and then notice how the thin filaments slide past the thick filaments. I want to emphasize there are no shortenings of these myosin or actin filaments. The only way for us to get muscle contraction is to pull and let those filaments slide past one another, just like we see here. So upon, you know, the completion of muscle shortening and contraction, if we're done with the process, we're going to restore those calcium ions where? Back in the SR, good. And of course, by removing the calciums from troponin, what happens to the rope of tropomyosin? Covers the binding sites, right. So now we no longer can form
a cross
bridge, right. So we're done with muscle contraction at that point. Okay, would you like to go through the entire process one more time, or do you feel okay? One more time, okay. All right, so we're back to the beginning. We're going to look at excitation, which is involving a motor neuron that's going to communicate with a muscle cell. And, of course, we can see one motor neuron here. We're looking at the nerve impulse traveling down the axon, and these little bud-like endings are called the axon terminals. Those axon terminals don't actually touch the neighboring muscle cell. There is a gap of space between the two known as synaptic cleft. Good. And since we can't actually tap the neighboring muscle cell and say, hey, I want you to contract, we communicate with a chemical known as
acetylcholine.
Good. And its category or classification is a neurotransmitter. All right, so let's pause here one more time. There comes that nerve impulse traveling down the axon terminal. On the bottom here, we see a muscle cell. All of this stuff down here is a muscle cell. And we're looking at the sarcolemma that contains a few of these little protein channels. Those protein channels are currently closed. What is it going to take to open them up?
Acetylcholine,
good. Why might you want to open them up? What's the purpose? Excitement, right. So we can excite this muscle cell by opening up those sodium channels. We also have these deep indentations or extensions of your plasma membrane or sarcolemma. These are known as?
Epithelial.
Good. And what's their function? Good. Take those nerve impulses deep into the muscle, straight to that SR. And down here in dark blue, you see the SR. It wraps around. The SR wraps around an organelle known as myofibril. Good. And that SR stores
calcium.
Good. Okay. So we've now got our action potential or nerve impulse that has excited this axon terminal. The excitement is going to open up a certain type of channel known as it's a protein channel. Good. And what comes into the axon terminal now?
Calcium.
There we come. So we've got it coming inside, and we've got these little vesicles here that are filled with a neurotransmitter.
Acetylcholine.
Good. It's like a blister. That vesicle ruptures by exocytosis. And here are all those acetylcholine molecules in the synaptic cleft. They bind to receptor sites on those sodium channels. And upon binding, those sodium channels will open up. And what happens next?
Sodium
rushes in. Good. So why is it critical for sodium to overpower and rush into that muscle cell? Good. Send the message of, hey, we're excited to the muscle cell, and we're going to worry about potassium later, but right now we're going to focus on sodium coming into that muscle cell. And the excitement is contagious. You know, neighboring sodium channels will get excited just because these down the line are excited, and they'll open and let sodium in as well. And the excitement is so contagious, here it goes down into one of these T-tubules, and it will let those SR know that we're excited and you should release
calcium.
Yeah. So we'll pick up with the contraction story in just a moment. But, you know, when we're done exciting a muscle cell, we can restore the acetylcholine back where?
Into the
axon terminal. Yeah. So it's going to travel through little channels back up into there for storage. And we need an enzyme to help us break down and return that acetylcholine. This enzyme is called
ACHE.
Good. So once we get rid of acetylcholine, those sodium channels on the sarcolemma will close. And the party's over. We've cleaned up. Everybody went home. And the excitement is now done inside your muscle. Your muscle cannot contract at this point. So let's pick up with the excitement. That's certainly more fun than cleaning up after the party. Okay, so like I mentioned, muscles can only shorten. They do this through sliding of filaments. That's where we get the sliding filament theory from. They don't push. You know, their job is to not push bones, but rather pull them. And you can see that what happens during muscle contraction is we're looking for a shortening of that sarcomere. So the underlying filaments are how we actually shorten the sarcomere through a sliding mechanism. So let's review one more time all the parts and components here. You're looking at a sarcomere, which is an individual unit of a myofibril. What is a myofibril?
It's an organelle.
An organelle, good. It's inside of a muscle cell, and its job is to do what?
Contract,
good. So a myofibril is made up of different kinds of proteins. Certain proteins are known as thick proteins. They're made up of what?
Myosin,
good. And they have little bumpy heads sticking up known as?
Myosin.
Good. We've also got thin filaments made up of three proteins. They are? Good. Actin, tropomyosin, and troponin complex. We made a joke on Monday that they are AT&T. And of course, they are bound to a membrane that is a zigzag-shaped known as
Z-line.
Good. We've also got some bands here that are revealed in the bigger picture. We've got light and dark bands that make up our striation pattern. So what are we looking for when we find an I band?
Thin filaments.
It's a light band. And what else is there?
The Z-line.
Yeah. What should not be in an I band? Thick filaments, yeah. Thick filaments should not be in the I band. If we're looking for an A band, we're looking for a zone or an area that contains all the thick. Good. And that's a dark band, good. So if we outline where those thick filaments are, that's going to be our A band. And right here through the middle is a special area called?
H-zone.
What's missing from the H zone?
Thin filaments.
Good. So we know this is a relaxed muscle because you can see two things. What are they?
H-zone and I-band.
Good. H-zone and I-band. Because had this been a contracted muscle, what would happen to them? Yeah, they'd disappear, they'd go away, and there you go. That's, they actually come closer together. Yep. All right, so we're going to find that calcium is already being released from the SR. That means the excitement was rampant inside that muscle cell. So calcium travels over to our thin filament and anchors to a particular portion known as troponin. Good, so it binds to troponin, and that allows a rope-like tropomyosin to reveal binding sites. All right, so when we want to release the head from its cross-bridge formation, we power it with an ATP molecule. And it's going to be critical that we do that because we need to repeat the process over and over to promote shortening of that muscle. Okay, so they're going to let that head relax back down in what's called a cocked position. It's ready to roll for the next cross-bridge cycle. So looking at this thin filament, how do you know it's ready for a cross-bridge to form?
The binding sites are open.
Yeah, binding sites are revealed. That allows the head to reach up and form a cross-bridge. Forming a cross-bridge is not enough to make a muscle contract. Power stroke. Good. So what does the power stroke do for that thin filament?
Pulls,
yeah. The head pivots and that pulls and slides that thin filament. But we need to do this repeatedly so the head is released using ATP. And as long as we've got those myosin heads in a cocked position, and as long as we've got those binding sites revealed, we can repeat the cross-bridge cycle again. Okay, so now the head is back in a cocked position. It's ready to go for another cross-bridge and another power stroke. And I think this is a critical image to watch. You've got those thin filaments sliding and being pulled past the thick filaments. What is the role of the myosin heads in doing this?
Slide them.
Yeah, the heads are sliding those thin filaments. Watch what happens to the distance between your Z lines during the shortening process. They move
closer,
yeah. Well, we're done, so it looks like the SR is going to restore what ions?
Calcium,
right. And by getting rid of the calcium, we can no longer form a cross-bridge cycle or slide those filaments. So what happens to our binding sites?
Covered up,
yep. Who does the covering?
Tropomyosin,
good. So now that myosin head, it can't attach to that binding site, so we're at a relaxed state at this point, and muscle contraction is over. Okay. How are you doing with this stuff?
Pretty good.
Just got to write it out, yes. So while it's fresh, go home and write it, right? I want to encourage you to not necessarily use the words as I've written them in your course pack. Do it how it makes sense for you. Yeah. And if you want me to read over what you've written to make sure you're getting it in your head the right way, send me what you've got. And I'll read it for you and send it back with any kind of feedback or suggestions. So I think this is a great story to go home and tell to somebody who will listen to it. Both of these animations are in the content area in D2L. They do have sound. You can actually turn it on and listen to it. And when you feel good, turn the sound off and then tell the story by yourself.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, and then you can tell the story. You're good to go. All right, so what I'd like to do is use a couple of analogies before we wrap up this concept. So I want you to think about the myosin heads relative to an oar that you might use to row a boat, okay? So if you've got an oar and you're in a boat and you put the oar in the water, that is the same thing as forming what?
A cross bridge.
A cross bridge, good. Now, if you're out in the middle of the ocean and you expect to go somewhere, and all you do is plop your oars in the water. You're not going anywhere, right? You're sitting there. So what does it take to get you moving? Power stroke. Yeah, move those paddles, exactly. So let those paddles move, that's power stroking. And what does that do to a thin filament when you power stroke?
Slide it,
yeah. So that is why we call this a sliding filament theory. It's not just the cross bridge, it is the power stroke that makes you slide, okay? So if you flip over with me to page 85, number 4 there has two boldface terms. Okay, and so what you normally do is called an isotonic contraction. That's put the cross bridge in place. It's a power stroke, and it makes those muscles shorten. So every time you move your arms to right to get up and walk, these are isotonic contractions. You shorten the muscle, movement is produced. And of course, the job here is to slide those filaments to produce a shortening of those muscles. Okay, so back when we studied all those muscle actions such as flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, where we're actually changing the angles between our muscles and bones, those are all isotonic contractions. We're actually changing movements between those bones and muscles. Sometimes you actually perform what's called an isometric contraction. In an isometric contraction, you form a cross bridge and you don't power stroke. Okay, so in an isometric contraction, you can form a cross bridge, you just don't make a power stroke. So what does not happen to your muscle cell? It doesn't shorten, yeah. So isometric contractions form cross bridges, but there's no power stroke, so there is no shortening of that muscle. You got it, yeah. If I lean against a wall, I can feel my muscle tighten from the cross bridges, but I'm not going anywhere, exactly. And if you think about it, to simply sit in your chair without slipping out on the floor, you're actually using isometric contractions in your back muscles to keep you in your chair. And if you didn't have those isometric contractions, you would slip out onto the floor. You know, if somebody faints in the classroom, and I've had that happen, I've had somebody in this very classroom faint, her muscles lost their isometric contractions, and there she went, she slipped out like a little noodle onto the floor. So, you know, we don't often think about how important those isometric contractions are.
The way you said it, like a little
noodle. She did. She was sitting along the wall over there, in fact, where Andrew sits, and she just slid out on the floor. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's a good one.
It's not funny.
Right, but that's a good way to keep it straight. I do want to point out something that's helpful. ISO is same. Metric is a length, like a meter, right?
Yeah.
So when you have an isometric contraction, you are having the same length of the muscle. It does not change length. Isotonic contractions do change length. Isometrics, however, stay the same length. So that may be helpful in keeping those two straight. Yeah, isotonics change length. Isometrics stay the same length. Okay.
Isometric creates the power stroke and isotonic doesn't, or is it the other way around?
Flip flop it, yeah. Isometric does a cross bridge and no power stroke. So isometric, like pushing on a wall, they do a cross bridge but no power stroke. Yeah, isometric.
Isometric, you can say it's resistant, right?
It's what?
It's resistant. Like the resistance is great.
The resistance is great, yeah, because you're not going to actually produce a movement.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, isometrics do a cross bridge, no power stroke there because we don't actually shorten the muscle. Let's see, we've talked about relaxation in the middle of the page. You've actually told me that story as part of the whole kit and caboodle, so we won't detail through that. But I did want to mention that smooth muscle at the bottom of the page is a little different. It doesn't have the striations that we expect to see with skeletal and cardiac muscle tissue. And the primary job here is to perform peristalsis. We know that smooth muscle can perform this job over long periods of time without getting tired. And that is not the case, though, for things like skeletal muscle. You know, if you had to stand with your arm up for 10 minutes, it wouldn't take long for all those muscles to get exhausted and tired. So the nature of smooth muscle is it doesn't tire easily, and it can perform contractions over a much longer period of time. So how would you describe what you see in this picture with peristalsis? Pushing something, yeah. So that's a lot of what we do with our muscles in these, say, blood vessels, urinary system, digestive system. We are contracting and moving things along, whether it's blood in the blood vessels, urine in the urinary system, or even food in the digestive tract. So, you know, imagine the heap of hurt we would be in if you had muscles that tired pushing along your blood. We'd be in a really bad situation if that was the case. So it's important that these continue long-term without tiring. Okie doke. So how about questions so far? That should wrap up page 85 for us. So I'd like to give your brain a rest and let you work on a puzzle for just a minute.
If you want to work with somebody, you're welcome.
Page 88 has types of muscle contractions. So when we do muscle contractions, they're what we call an all or none experience. You either produce a muscle contraction or you don't. Your brain does not send partial messages for muscle contractions. So you may wonder how some muscle contractions feel stronger than others. You know, to pick up this remote on the table requires very little effort, as opposed to actually picking up the table itself. So what we end up doing when we need stronger muscle contractions is we recruit help. Just like if you're going to move, you don't want to move by yourself.
No.
You want friends to help. So you recruit people, and that's what muscles do. So recruitment is a way for us to increase muscle tension. That term is actually at the very top of your page. You know, I was talking about sitting in your chair, not sliding out on the floor like a little noodle. That's muscle tension. So that is a type of isometric contraction. It's a constant muscle tension, and that keeps you upright. So even when you're standing, you know, if you don't have muscle tension and some isometric contractions, you're also going to fall over. So, you know, it's really important that our muscles stay at a constant state of contraction, especially some of them all the time. So what I'd like to do is walk you through the muscle twitch pictured on your worksheet as a way to explain how a muscle gets ready and contracts. So in this picture, let me just hit the picture first. You'll notice that in milliseconds, we have a muscle contract and relax. And what you're looking at here is actually just a simple twitch. You ever had a muscle twitch before?
Yeah, like
your eye. Really irritating, right? So you'll notice that the stimulus comes at the beginning of this muscle twitch. And at the stimulus point, this is when acetylcholine is released onto those little sarcolemma protein channels. So right here at the latent period, we've got, goodness, hardly just a few milliseconds, during which time acetylcholine tells those sodium channels to open. And what happens next? Yes. Good. So acetylcholine binds those receptors on sodium channels, sodium rushes in, and the internal environment becomes positive with excitement. Good. All of that is just a few milliseconds in that latent period. All right, what happens next? What does your SR now do? Good. Calcium travels to an actin filament and binds. Troponin. Good. And that moves a rope called tropomyosin. And now you've got binding sites revealed. And of course, with binding sites revealed, those myosin heads can reach up and form cross bridges. And of course, they pivot, forming a. Good. And then they release powered by
ATP.
And as long as you've got revealed binding sites, you're going to form another cross bridge, do another power stroke, release once again. So the whole repetitive process is going to cause your muscle filaments to
short
and slide. Exactly. So the shortening comes from the fact that the sarcomere gets shorter. The filaments themselves don't shorten. They just slide past one another. So the goal here is to produce a muscle contraction. And during a muscle twitch, that's hardly 15 milliseconds of time. Well, eventually, the acetylcholine is put back into its axon terminal thanks to an enzyme known as ACHE, good. And the SR restores
calcium.
And that prevents further cross bridges from taking place. You know what? It's just like real life. You can surely mess up your room easier than you can clean up your room. So notice that we can contract much more quickly than we can clean up during the relaxation phase. But a muscle twitch is less than a half of a second. It is not the normal way for nerve impulses to operate. Normally, we should have more than one skeletal muscle being stimulated to produce any kind of viable muscle contraction. But that's what twitches are. There's some stress for the system. Perhaps sleep is the issue there with a muscle twitch. When I was pregnant with my, she's 10 now, but when I was pregnant with her, I had muscle twitches for, I think, God, it was 6 months. When she was born, the muscle twitches went away. They're all around your eye, you know. So they say it's a nervous system issue, it's stress, it's something going on in your body that can lead to those twitches, but they're certainly not normal for muscles to operate this way. When you pull a muscle, it may in fact be stretched and torn, so it's going to take a long time to repair. So if you pull those filaments further apart, then they're going to have a harder time contracting and sliding in the first place.
So that when you have a bigger H zone?
You could. In fact, it may be multiple tears, and all those H zones may in fact be bigger. Yeah. So they're going to have a hard time shortening those sarcomeres, and because skeletal is slow to heal, it takes much longer for that to heal than, say, other tissue types. Yep. So I'd like to walk you through twitches, trepi, unfused tetanus at the bottom of your page, and fused tetanus at the very bottom of your page. I want you to notice the arrows on this myogram, which is a tracing of muscle activity. Those arrows indicate a jolt of acetylcholine. Okay, so that's like a nerve impulse telling that muscle cell, hey, contract. So those black arrows on here, those are jolts of acetylcholine. So you'll notice that the first picture there is called a muscle twitch. It is pictured, by the way, I know you guys just flipped the page over at the top of 89. So the muscle twitch is simply one jolt of acetylcholine and one very small muscle contraction in response. Trepi, the next picture, has more jolts of acetylcholine, but you're letting your muscle do a little contraction, and you're waiting too long, and the muscle starts to relax. Along comes another jolt of acetylcholine, and we start to climb in muscle tension. And again, we're waiting too long to jolt it again, so it falls back to a relaxed state, and then another jolt comes along, and we see another climb in that muscle tension. So what we're doing is we're increasing the frequency of muscle contractions, but they're just not close enough together to produce a full-on muscle contraction that you can do work with. What do you notice about summation of twitches? This is unfused tetanus. What about those jolts of acetylcholine?
More jolts.
Look at the timing. They're coming faster, right? Mm-hmm. Giving your muscle less time to do what?
Relax, right.
So this time, notice the muscle tension is much greater than what you saw for Trepi. We're coming so quickly with acetylcholine that those muscles stay contracted and there's less opportunity to fall back to a relaxed state. That's how you normally operate. You normally operate at that unfused tetanus region where your muscles are getting jolts of acetylcholine enough to recruit some friends and you can pick up and do some work. We don't like to experience fused or complete tetanus, which is the last picture. Notice those arrows are coming so fast, your muscle has no chance for what?
Relaxation.
And what happens to the muscle tension? It climbs, yeah. And in fact, it's so up there that your muscle stays in a contracted state. This is what you call a Charlie horse or a muscle cramp. And we don't like to feel like that because we don't want our muscles to stay in a contracted state.
So what are exactly the two middle ones?
We experience something along the lines of Trepi and the summation of twitches. That's your normal muscle movements. We, of course, know what a twitch feels like, but when you start summing them together, you start getting small contractions, lightweight contractions. If you need more tension, then you've got the summation of twitches, where you've got more work that can be done with more muscle groups.
Okay, so one's just lightweight and the other one's...
You could think of it that way, yeah. Do y'all have any questions on the twitch diagram on this picture or the other myogram picture here?
Now,
just go ahead, John.
What is the experience with summation of twitches and traction? I mean, is he just, what are you going through?
Your normal muscle movements are in those two categories, more toward the summation category than the Trepi category, but when you're moving, you're summing twitches. When you're infused tetanus, you're locked up. So it's weird to think that we're in unfused tetanus when we're doing our normal movements, but that's where we feel most comfortable. Okay.
You know what, I have a question.
Sure.
So you're running... And you get that stomach cramp.
Like a side stitch.
Yeah. Would that be considered a summation of twitches? Because it's not as bad as...
Right. If you stop and you breathe and it tends to go away, it's probably somehow deprived of oxygen. And it probably is summation of twitches. And like you said, it's not horrible enough to make you stop and cry.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But it's probably somewhere in that summation category.
How about rest?
That is, if I understand correctly, a nervous system issue. And if the nervous system is constantly sending messages that say, hey, you should contract, you're probably looking at somewhere in this neighborhood here. If it's not causing full-on muscle cramps in your sleep, then you're not getting to that tetanus stage. Yeah. Since we're kind of on the topic of this stuff, I did want to mention tetanus, which we've all heard about tetanus shots. The tetanus shot is actually meant to prevent full, complete, fused tetanus, which means your muscle does not have an opportunity to relax. There is a bacterium that's common in our environment called Clostridium, and if it gets into your body, it releases a toxin. That toxin is what the tetanus shot is trying to prevent you from having, cause you to have full or complete tetanus. So it's kind of weird to call the shot tetanus when that's what it's meant to prevent you from having, but... the goal here is to prevent you from having lockjaw, which is a common issue with this particular bacterium. This bacteria lives in the soil. You know, you can get it from an open cut on your hand if you're working in soil, like gardening. It can be found on metal objects as well. Your mom has probably told you don't walk in the yard barefoot. You'll step on rusty stuff and you'll get tetanus. So it is common on rusted metal outdoor objects. And back in the day before our time, you know, people were shot with cannonballs or musket balls that had Clostridium. The lucky ones were probably the ones that died from the musket ball wound. The unfortunate ones had to live for 2 to 3 months with Clostridium, causing them to go into complete body writhing contractions like you see here. So until your body fought off and killed the bacteria, then you had full or complete tetanus migrate through your muscles. So that had to be extremely painful. It'd be like Charlie horses, you know, for the majority of your body. Yeah. And a lot of people it did, but some, I guess, unfortunate folks made it through. I couldn't imagine for, yeah. It probably did, and that's probably what killed a number of them. Yeah.
Can they even talk in that space?
Probably not. If it affects these muscles, probably not. Yeah.
How are you going to last like that for like months, or they had to be moved?
That was probably not a continuous thing. It probably writhed in and out of those contractions.
Oh.
And maybe it lasted for 30 minutes or an hour. Maybe then they relaxed. It just depends on how the bacteria were doing in their body. Yeah. Yeah, no thank you. One of the two poisonous spiders in this state is the black widow spider. I'm sure you've all heard about the hourglass shape on the belly. Mm-hmm. There is that hourglass shape. This particular spider produces a toxin, and the toxin induces increased ACH release. Okay, so what happens when you have too much acetylcholine?
Cramps.
Where do you go?
Right to the end.
Right, so it's cramps. So it causes full or complete tetanus, fused tetanus is what they call it, and acetylcholine jolts are coming constantly to your muscle, and your muscle just stays in a constantly contracted state. So, yeah, that's an unfortunate thing about having a black widow spider bite. Botox, you know, we've all heard about this one for wrinkles, is actually useful for other things like excess sweating in the armpit region. The cool thing about Botox is you're actually putting another bacterial toxin into your body. It lasts for about 6 months, and what it does is it decreases acetylcholine release. So going back to our picture here, does it take you toward fused or complete tetanus or toward the other end? Towards the twitch end, yeah. So it keeps your muscles in more of a paralyzed state where they can't move than it does in a fully contracted state. So kind of an interesting thing. They use it from botulinum toxin. It's from a bacterium, actually. Yeah. Okay. Looks like a good time for a break. Why don't we do a break for about 5 minutes and come back about 9:10 or 9:11 or so, and then we'll get started with bottom of page 89, and that'll wrap us up. Okay, on page 89, underneath the myogram picture, we're going to be talking about that number 2, recruitment. Okay, so under the picture on page 89, you'll notice number 2 there, it says recruitment. I did mention that to you as another way to increase muscle tension, and I just wanted you to see that when you are doing work, you know, if you're picking up heavier objects, moving heavier items, you may need to recruit additional motor units to make the muscle tension greater. So that's what they're showing us here, that, you know, if you need just a lightweight object, you may not use but one motor unit. And if you do more heavy work, you may, in fact, use multiple motor units. If you've ever carried heavy boxes while you're moving, you may notice that, you know, you're walking, you're going, I'm going to drop this, I'm going to drop this. So what's happening is, motor units will cycle on, motor units will cycle off, and eventually all the motor units say, hey, I'm done, I give up, I'm tired, and you drop it, right? So that's what's happening, is motor units will do their cycling as long as they can until they eventually are exhausted, and then we drop our items. You drop it, yep. Okay. I'm not going to cover fast and slow twitches. You know, you can mark those off. They're an interesting read because they're the story behind chickens and light meat and dark meat, but nonetheless, I'm going to skip that. You can mark those off. What's that? Yeah. You want to hear? I can do it quick. Fast fibers and slow fibers, yeah.
I just want to know how it makes you.
The color of the muscle tissue actually comes from something called myoglobin. And myoglobin is like hemoglobin in that it stores oxygen molecules in muscle tissue. And if you've got myoglobin with the oxygen, then it's dark. So that particular muscle tissue is what we call a slow twitch muscle tissue.
So there's more oxygen in the
leg. Exactly. Then, yeah, for breast meat, because it's white and that's got fast twitch fibers so they can fly quickly, but they're used to spending their entire day walking in the farmland, whatever. In us, you know, just since we're kind of on the topic of fast and slow twitch, if you talk about a sprinter who's fast out of the gate, extremely quick, but doesn't have the endurance to run a marathon, they got fast twitch fibers. On the other hand, if you've got somebody who's not fast out of the gate but has the endurance to last 26 miles for a marathon, they got the slow twitch fibers. So
is that like blood doping that runners do?
It is EPO injections, which is an erythropoietin hormone. We talk about it in 211. And that actually increases your red blood cell count so you can transport more oxygen. Yep.
So would that,
kind of
like, if you have more oxygen here?
Yeah. You've got more ATP if you've got more oxygen. Yeah. Dangerous stuff because it can give you things like a stroke.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's not.
But didn't
Lance Armstrong, yeah. Yeah, denied it for years because there was not a viable test to actually reveal that he was blood doping, but yeah, I guess there was so much pressure and so much other evidence out there he gave in.
But, I thought, never
mind. Okay. Hypertrophy, atrophy at the bottom of the page, pretty clear difference here. Hypertrophy is muscles that increase in size. Atrophy, of course, is the lack of a muscle use, and it decreases in size, unable to do the job. So exercise can promote hypertrophy. What do you think might promote atrophy of a muscle? Not using it. Yeah. Sedentary, good paralysis, comas, yep. Even being put in a cast can cause a muscle to atrophy. The last page I'd like to take you through in this chapter is page 90. We're going to talk a bit about ATP. Making ATP is basic math. ATP, the T there stands for three phosphate groups. We know its name as adenosine triphosphate, and this is what we think of as a high energy form of the molecule. We can make ATP by combining a phosphate group with ADP. Technically, the D there is di, or two phosphate groups. So I kind of think of it this way. If you've got money to spend, you have ATP. You've got the high energy form of the molecule. If you don't have money, don't have money to spend, you're in the ADP mode, right? Okay. We know a lot about the ADP mode, huh?
Oh, yeah.
That phosphate group,
yeah,
that can be removed and taken off. And when we remove the phosphate group, we actually, you know, knock that energy molecule down a notch to ADP. So the phosphate group can come over to something like a protein channel. It can bind that protein channel, put a P there, and it will make that protein channel open or protein pump open or whatever. So that phosphate group is what we use to do energy. So if you're in the ATP mode, you have the money to spend, so to speak. You have the extra phosphate to give away. If you're in ADP mode, you don't have extra money to spend. In other words, you don't have an extra phosphate group to give away. So what you need is ATP to be able to do work. So that's what we're going to look at, is three ways to make ATP. One is very efficient, others are not so, but nonetheless, they still make ATP in the long run. All right, so any questions about ATP as an energy molecule so far? Okay. So I'd like to mention the first type there on your page is called aerobic cellular respiration, and this is the most efficient way to make ATP. You know, if making ATP was like gas mileage, this is the way to go. For one glucose molecule, you get around 34 to 36 ATP molecules. Hey, if that was gas mileage and you're looking at 36 miles per gallon, we would say that that's pretty good gas mileage. I don't know how many more years I'm going to be able to use this analogy because cars get more efficient, and eventually 36 miles per gallon is not going to be so good. But for our case here, one glucose molecule makes 34 to 36 ATPs. So where do you get glucose from?
Sugar.
Yes, so your sugar molecules are glucose. Only one glucose is needed to make a good number of ATPs. So can you tell me during muscle contraction at least one time you need an ATP molecule? Yeah. Take that myosin head, relax it back in its cocked position, and then it can form another cross bridge and power stroke. Yeah, in fact, even doing the cross bridge power stroke structure also takes another ATP. So if you don't have ATP, the whole muscle contraction stuff is just dead in the water. Can't do it. So the catch is aerobic, the term there, means with oxygen. We're actually transforming glucose in the presence of oxygen into around 36 ATPs. Where do you get the oxygen from?
Water, breathing.
Breathing, yeah. So breathing in and out and eating food is what allows us to make ATP. If you do anything to disrupt the oxygen supply or the glucose supply, then we end up having not enough ATP for muscle contractions. All right, so you may have seen this before. This is the reaction. It produces aerobic cellular respiration, or 36 ATP molecules. You'll notice that glucose and oxygen are two reactants here. They are transformed by mitochondria into 34 to 36 ATPs, and the waste product of carbon dioxide is removed by your respiratory system. So, you know, when we're thinking about our mitochondria making ATP, we oftentimes don't realize that the respiratory system serves the mitochondria by bringing in oxygen and getting rid of that CO2. All right, so let's talk about the number two there, direct phosphorylation of ADP by creatine phosphate. I know I just said something in a foreign language. Okay, so let's break this down. All right, so here's my problem. I want to make ATP. Okay, that's the form that allows me to have an extra phosphate group to do work. Okay, and I don't have enough ADP, so what I'm going to do instead is use another molecule called creatine phosphate, and that is going to give me the phosphate group that I need. So instead of actually taking a phosphate group that's by itself, I'm going to borrow the phosphate group from a creatine phosphate molecule. So that still gives me three phosphates for an ATP. Okay? So when you're sitting here in the classroom, you're making aerobic respiration, your primary mechanism for making ATP. Nobody's in here breathing heavy. Nobody's doing a lot of exercise. The minute that you get up and leave this classroom today, that aerobic respiration is not going to be enough to give you ATP to move. So you're going to kick on this secondary method known as creatine phosphate. Notice it only lasts you a sad 15 seconds. So as you continue to pack up your bags and leave the classroom and start to walk down the hallway, this isn't going to last you but 15 seconds, and you will have used up your stored supplies of creatine phosphate. Okay, so what do? You don't drop ever dead, right? You actually have a supplemental way, and it's called anaerobic cellular respiration. All right, so our third mechanism for making ATP is by doing it anaerobically. And what does the word anaerobic tell us?
No oxygen needed,
right. So we still use glucose here, but we transform it directly into ATP without using the oxygen. What does that do to your gas mileage? Decrease it. Yeah, you had good gas mileage with aerobic respiration. You got about 36 molecules of ATP for every glucose because you made it with oxygen. But when you stop using oxygen and you simply transform glucose directly into ATP, Notice your gas mileage is horrible. Mm-hmm. It's now down to 2 ATPs for glucose molecule. So we're still doing the same thing. We're still taking a phosphate group and adding it to an ADP molecule. It just, it's, you know, we're only making around 2 because this is a highly inefficient process. So as you walk wherever you go after class today, you may notice that your respiration rate is picking up. Why do you think you breathe faster when you're moving and exercising?
More air.
More air, more oxygen. Because what are you trying to get back and do? Make ATP what way?
Aerobically.
Yeah, you want to do it this way because you need the oxygen, because it's a more fuel-efficient way to make that ATP. So go ahead.
Is that why people who like work out a lot take creatine to add more oxygen?
That would be one. Well, it'd be a way to make you more ATP because it only lasts to 15 seconds. But if you kind of preload your body with the creatine stuff, or creatine, that's going to give you more ATP in the long run. So your muscles get adjusted to having that as kind of a booster for their ATP production. So as long as you're exercising, you're going to be breathing hard because your body's paying off a debt, trying to get you back to the aerobic respiration cycle. Why is this the preferred manner for making ATP? Yeah, you make more of it, like 34 to 36 per glucose. So this is by far the best and most efficient way to make ATP. So if you climb the stairs in this building, I'm guessing I'm not alone that you start breathing like the heavy breather, right? Okay, so even when you hit the fourth floor, you don't stop breathing heavily, right? It may be a few minutes before your breathing rate finally slows back down. So even though you're no longer exercising, why are you still breathing heavy? You're still making an adjustment because you are paying off an oxygen debt, trying to get yourself back to the most efficient way to make ATP, which is aerobic mechanisms. Okay, so I know this is kind of thick territory here. What I would look at are the questions in the middle of the page. Let me run you through those in the dead center of page 90. Out of our three mechanisms, which one makes the most ATP?
Aerobic.
Good, aerobic respiration. And it uses what to make the most efficient mechanism?
Oxygen
and glucose, yeah. The least amount of ATP is made by our second one there, direct phosphorylation. We can simply call it creatine phosphate. So the second process, creatine phosphate, only makes one ATP molecule. Produces painful lactic acid is actually a byproduct of our third step, anaerobic respiration. If you've ever exercised and had your muscles begin to burn, if you stop exercising, the burn will often go away, and you restart exercising, the burn comes back. That lactic acid is painful and it builds up on our muscles. It actually can be used to make more glucose or more ATP, but we know that when we have that lactic acid buildup that we're doing anaerobic respiration. It apparently builds up on the muscles as a layer, and the liver ultimately has to get rid of it and break it down. So if we build up enough of it, then it doesn't get broken down fast enough by the liver, so we have pain for some extended time on our muscles.
Why does rubbing it
Probably two things happening. If your muscles are sore from overuse, that can massage more blood into the area. And secondly, if there's excess lactic acid, you're pushing it out into the bloodstream so it can go to the liver and be broken down. That's probably what's going on with massage. Yeah.
And it just builds up during heavy exercise?
It does.
Anytime we do it, like there's nothing to prevent from coming as much?
If a person is a routine athlete and has routine exercise, your body will accommodate and not build up as much. If you're a weekend warrior of athleticism, where you go out and you run like crazy and then the rest of the time you're sedentary, then your body does not accommodate and you'll actually build up lactic acid every time you exercise when it's sporadic like that. So they say that routine exercise can actually eliminate lactic acid buildup for a large part. That's why somebody who's a routine marathon runner doesn't have the lactic acid buildup like somebody who's an occasional runner. Yeah. Cool stuff. The next bullet point there turns glycogen into glucose is also anaerobic respiration. So you want to know how to lose weight. That's how you do it. You get to the anaerobic state, you exercise, and once you've burned off your glucose supplies, you tackle your glycogen supplies. And when you start burning your glycogen, your next step is to burn off, guess what? Fat. Yeah. So the way to increase the loss of weight is to get into that anaerobic mode, make your body work harder, and then it burns off that glycogen to make glucose. So turning glycogen into glucose is anaerobic. Let's see, the next question, what type of ATP production is used during rest?
Aerobic,
good. So using oxygen, aerobic respiration. And during heavy exercise?
Anaerobic,
good. Just a couple of last topics at the bottom of your page that are related. Muscle fatigue is down there at the very bottom of your page. Muscles need blood and oxygen, of course oxygen, to work properly. They need ATP for their contractions to work. And we need to have intact, non-damaged muscle tissue to work properly. So without one of these, your muscles fatigue and they will not respond to stimuli. Even if you say legs run, they just won't work. So people that, you know, if you've ever watched a marathon or been participating in one, somebody may collapse across the finish line. You know, if you're thinking drama queen or whatever, it may in fact not be anything to do with the drama of finishing a marathon. It may entirely be that the muscles have some deficit, blood, oxygen, ATP, or damage to the structures. So if the person says, you know, brain says to those legs, run, there is no contraction that's going to take place until those muscles restore one of these primary needs to get moving again.
And people who have like the adrenaline while they're doing that, and they're like crawling.
That's true, they're crawling because they can't get their muscles to respond. Yep. The final thing on that page is called oxygen debt. It's got a real fancy name. It's called excess post-exercise oxygen consumption. Let's just call it oxygen debt and be done with it. When you climb the stairs in this building and you get to the fourth floor and you're no longer climbing stairs, it may take several minutes for your breathing to return back to a normal respiration rate. What you're doing is you're repaying your oxygen debt. Your body wants to do aerobic respiration. Why is that the preferred method for making ATP? A lot more, yeah. You're making 36 ATPs as opposed to one or two. So during this time period, you're going to be breathing heavy to pay off your debt. And when you pay off your debt, your respiration rate should return back to normal. As long as you're in anaerobic respiration, which is what you're doing when you're exercising, you may have excess lactic acid built up on your body, and you may only make about 2 ATPs per glucose molecule. So certainly not an efficient way to make ATPs. All right, so this is a pretty thick page. Do you have any questions, anything I can clarify for you on page 90? We've got a little bit of time. I'd like to start you off in the nervous system just to get your foundation laid. And then Monday after the break, we will hit nerve impulse transmission. Alternately, I cannot lay the foundation today, and I can just dive straight into nerve impulse transmission so you have the tough stuff out of the way first. Do you have a preference for how we do it? Okay. I can either do the foundational stuff today and do nerve impulse transmission Monday after break, or I can do nerve impulse today. Tough stuff today. Okay. It's okay. I'll tell you what page to turn to. The foundation starts on 92... 93, that is all something I think you can probably read and feel good about. 94, that's all foundation stuff. 95, though, starts nerve impulse transmission. So if you want to do tough stuff, let's hit 95. Okay. So what we're talking about is how nerves transmit nerve impulses. Nerve impulses are called action potentials. Okay. And when we talked about excitation of a muscle cell just a few minutes ago, that excitement stuff is the same thing that happens in a muscle and a nerve cell. So it's all the same story. What I need to do, though, is give you some details that I left out when we did the excitation story and contraction story just a bit ago. So what I need to tell you is this, that when muscles and nerves are at rest, they are polarized, meaning they have an unequal distribution of ions on either side of their plasma membranes. We'd learned that polarity way back when with water was an uneven sharing of electrons. Well, this time polarized means an uneven distribution of charges. The two ions that we're looking at are sodiums and potassiums. So what symbol does sodium carry?
Na.
Na, good. And potassium?
Na.
Ok, good. So we're looking at an axon of a nerve cell. Okay, and down here is where we've got the cell body. We're going to ignore that area for right now. And we're just going to take a snapshot of the axon of a neuron. Hey, this could be a muscle cell. Same story goes for that as well. So you'll notice in a polarized state, where are most of our sodium ions found?
Outside.
Yeah. Outside, good. So I'm going to stick some sodium ions outside my muscle cell or nerve cell here. Making sure I had a lot of sodiums up here. You'll notice there's a lot of sodium sitting on the outside of this cell at rest. This particular plasma membrane does not like sodiums to come and go at their leisure, so it is a fairly impermeable membrane to sodiums. We're not going to let them in unless we invite them in. They're kind of unruly once they get on the inside. So the catch is that sodiums are stuck on the outside unless they're invited to come into the inside. You know the story. How did they get in?
Through
neurotransmitter.
Through the pump.
Yes. Good.
Sodium
channel. Yeah. So they get in through the sodium channel when they're invited to come in. Otherwise, they stay on the outside of the cell. The potassiums are inside the cell. Okay, and in terms of abundance here, I have a lot of sodiums on the outside of my muscle or nerve cell. I have a relative few number of potassiums on the inside. You'll notice that both sodiums and potassiums are cations, meaning they carry what charge?
Positive.
Positive. Okay, so here's the issue. I have a lot of sodiums. I have a few potassiums. So instead of saying I have a really strong positive charge outside and a fairly weak positive charge on the inside, that gets really confusing. So they have made this a very black and white issue, and they simply say, wherever the majority of the ions are, you carry a positive charge. Okay? Right now, at rest, we have a polarized neuron, and the majority of my ions are outside the cell. So the outside of the cell carries a positive charge. Wherever the majority of my ions are, that's where we have a positive charge. Wherever I have a few ions, good, you got it, negative charge. Are you so far so good? Okay. The charge, by the way, inside is negative 70 millivolts at rest. Okay, charge inside at rest is negative 70 millivolts. So I told you how the sodiums are unruly. We don't let them in unless they're invited through one of those sodium channels. But I need to tell you also that potassiums come and go as they please. So it's constantly leaking potassiums from the inside to the outside. Well, when you do that, you upset this charge of negative 70 millivolts. We have a way to fix this, and it's right here. It's called a sodium-potassium pump. And when the pump is working, we're going to move sodiums across the membrane three at a time, and we move two potassiums across the membrane in the opposite direction. So I kind of think of it like a corral for sheep. You know, the sheep are constantly escaping, and you're constantly going back and getting them and putting them back inside. That sodium-potassium pump sits here on your plasma membrane, and its job is to constantly gather up those escaped potassiums, return them to the inside of your membrane, and any sodiums that may be in here, put them back on the outside where they belong. So would you say the sodium-potassium pump is assisting the resting state or working against the resting state? It's assisting, yeah. So it's doing exactly what we want. It's putting potassiums back inside, and it's taking any sodiums and returning to the outside. So for this reason, we call it a sodium-potassium pump. It's pumping sodiums in one direction out and potassiums in the other direction in. Let me make a point here. There's three sodiums pumped out and two potassiums pumped in. What if we were pumping three out and three in? Or two out and two in? Yeah, you'd mess up your balance, right? The polarization has to have less inside, more outside. Three is certainly more than two. Okay? So the reason we pump three out and only two back in is to keep that polarization straight. That way we have less ions inside, more ions outside.
Is that a question that goes in?
That is probably a question, yeah.
Is that a discussion question?
It's probably a multiple choice question, yeah. So that should cover most of 95. There is a summary chart at the bottom of the page. I think we're good to flip on over to 96. So when we talked about opening up sodium channels, we required some kind of neurotransmitter. The one we were using was called acetylcholine. We can just continue with that conversation. There's other neurotransmitters, but you know, they all do different jobs, but the one we're looking for is one that opens up our sodium channels. So let's say that right about here we have a set of sodium channels, and there we go, we've got an acetylcholine molecule that comes along and sits on that sodium channel. So this is going to cause for us to have a depolarization event. What happens to our sodium channel when acetylcholine binds?
It
opens up, good. And in fact, the excitement is contagious. It doesn't even take an acetylcholine. The neighboring one says, you got to open, I want to too. And so it says, I'm going to open too. It does. And this one down here says, oh, me too, I'm going to open too. So it's voltage-gated channels here that get excited by each other, and they open up down the line, one after another, going, oh, me too, me three, me four, and keeps on opening down that line. Well, what happens when you have open sodium channels?
Sodium
comes in. What happens to a charge inside when you all of a sudden have a crowd?
Becomes positive.
Good. Guess who's still inside?
Potassium.
Yeah, potassium's still inside. Okay. So it's kind of like a read here on this voltage scale. When you excite that nerve cell using acetylcholine, we open up those sodium channels and sodium starts to rush in. When sodium starts to rush in, we're putting the majority of our ions inside of our cell. So we're upsetting that balance of a polarized neuron. In essence, we're doing what's called depolarization. So as we move sodiums in, we move from negative 70, which is a resting state, negative 60, negative 55 is hit, and at that point we reach what is called threshold. Threshold is a really critical number because at this point there's no turning back. We now have so many sodium ions coming into our cell that we're guaranteed what? An action potential, good, yeah. And an action potential is the very same thing as a nerve impulse. So threshold guarantees an action potential. There is nothing halfway. There's another word for it I'd like to say, but there's nothing halfway about producing, you know what I'm saying, right? There's nothing halfway about producing a nerve impulse. It is all or none. Good. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, it's all or none. Now it's on the recording, so. But yeah, when you hit threshold, that's it. You have negative 55, you're going for it. There's no turning back. You have enough sodiums in there to do the job, and if action potential is guaranteed, and that contagion is going to continue opening up sodium channels down the length of your nerve cell. So we're looking for this contagiousness to conduct the nerve impulse down the length of your neuron. Now, those open sodium channels let even more sodium come in, and we eventually have so many sodiums inside that we reach a positive 30 millivolt value. So that's like the height of a nerve impulse transmission. There are so many sodiums inside, and actually just a few sodiums left on the outside of those nerve cells at that time. Let's see, on your worksheet about how to be done, there's something called a graded potential. Graded potential can lead to an action potential if you reach
the threshold,
yeah. So if you have a localized area of depolarization, then you may get an action potential if you open up enough sodium channels. The catch is graded depolarization may be negative 60, and the sodium potassium pump puts everything back at rest. If the graded potential reaches negative 55, what is it turned into?
It's
action potential. You're game on, right? So let me put it to you this way. When somebody sits at a stoplight and revs his engine or her engine, if the car stalls, you didn't reach threshold, right? But when the light turns green and you're off and running, you reach threshold, you're going, okay? So threshold is kind of that critical value for making things run. Another way to think of threshold is like being in a stadium. If you've ever been at a football game outside where they're doing the wave or a basketball game, you know, somebody can throw up their arms and everybody sits there and looks and says, yeah, I'm not doing that. A few more people are doing it, and then of course, here you go, the whole stadium is doing it. It takes critical mass to get threshold, right? So until you get threshold, that wave is not going to travel around that stadium. So hit threshold, you're good to go with an action potential or nerve impulse. Okay, let's see if there's something else on that page. Hyperpolarization. impulse is done, you're actually going to have enough sodiums and potassiums leave the cell that you get into a very negative state that we call hyperpolarization. This means that you're more polarized than negative 70 millivolts. So in fact, if potassiums leak out, trying to return our cell back to a resting state, we are going to move further negative than just simply negative 70 millivolts. So in the case of 120, negative 120, you are really far away from threshold, right? So your likelihood of producing an action potential when you're hyperpolarized is like none. So why might you want to hyperpolarize any cell? What would that make that cell do? Rest. Makes it rest, yeah. You know, they told you not to swim after you eat a big meal? Okay, so guess what cells are hyperpolarized? Muscles, yeah. So if you go out and go for a swim and cells are trying to be at rest, they're trying to stay hyperpolarized, you're now going to have problems, right? You've got muscle cramps. So that's the case here of hyperpolarization. It forces cells to stay at rest because we actually move it so negative. Are you doing okay with this so far? Okay, and we'll definitely rerun the entire story that Monday after break. Okay, so the last phase is to flip the page with me. Repolarization is page 97. If we want to be at rest, what charge should we have inside our muscle cell?
Negative
70. Negative 70, good. And we want to have negative charges lining the inside of your membrane, positive charges on the outside of that membrane. And if you compare what I've drawn here to what you see during action potential, you definitely don't see that setup. So we've got to clean up our mess, so to speak. And we've got to return our ions back to their proper location. So let's put a pump here and watch that pump work. So in order to get our negative charge restored first, we're going to utilize a sodium potassium pump. What does it do for us? Good. How many sodiums go out?
Three.
And how many potassiums come back in?
Two.
Okay, so by doing this, how does that contribute to getting our negative 70 charge restored?
Keeps
it polarized or repolarized by putting the majority of your ions outside. That's the catch. The majority of your ions is where the positive charge is going to be. And so we're going to move our sodiums and our potassiums back into their proper locations. Okay, and then of course we get our potassiums here back on the inside. So here's something to think about. If the sodium potassium pump is moving sodiums out, we know they were on the inside to begin with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they had migrated in through those open sodium channels. But the catch is, how in the world did the potassiums end up out here? Yeah, they leak out, right? Remember, they come and go kind of how they want to. And when we had all this party inside, they're like, oh no, we don't. We don't hang out with that many. We're leaving. So as soon as those sodiums started flooding in, the potassium said, oh, I'm out of here. And they will actually exit through those potassium channels.
So it's like a facilitated diffusion?
It is a facilitated diffusion, yeah. It's a protein channel, exactly. So that's, in fact, how the potassiums got out. It was too hot in the house. They left. They leaked out through potassium channels. And so what we need to do is put them back where they belong, which is back inside the neuron. So, yeah, use the pump. Get everybody back in their proper locations. And until that pump is done cleaning up the place, you cannot conduct another action potential. In fact, we call this a refractory period. You cannot fire again another impulse until you clean up the place from the first go around. Okay? So,
what's that called again?
Refractory period. And that's actually bottom of that page.
And so it just can't clean up another impulse until everything, I guess, is polarized again.
Right, if you polarize it again.
Where did you say that was at?
Very bottom of 97.
Okay.
Sure.
The little box thing, like the potassium channel?
That's the potassium channel, that's right. Both men and women have refractory periods. Okay? So both men and women have refractory periods. This is what the time it is to reset the nerve impulse before it can happen again. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Mm-hmm. Orgasm.
Yes.
Okay? So. Y'all have a great break. That is it. That is the whole story. So you got the whole theme down. Yep. When you come back Monday.